Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Magner. Today, we travel back in time to revisit the classic video game Pong 50 years after its release and how the emergence of video games impacted popular culture. All right. How many of you remember Pong? Its concept was about as simple as its name. It took two players, each person controlling a paddle, hitting an electronic ball back and forth across a screen. Pong was found in arcades, or if you were lucky enough to have it at home, the paddles were connected to a video game console wired to your television. Think of it like a pixelated version of ping pong. And yes, I know, when younger people compare this simplistic game to the flashier, more complex modern titles like Minecraft or Call of Duty or Madden Football, they might wonder how people even stayed awake while playing Pong. But back when it was released in 1972, Pong was a smash. In fact, it was the first video game to become a mass hit. And it marked a turning point for an industry that, according to MarketWatch, generated about $180 billion of revenue in 2020. Yes, that's billion with a B. Our guest today, Michael Newman, wrote a book called Atari Age: The Emergence of Video Games in America. Published in 2017, the book takes a detailed swing at Pong, and this seems like a good time to revisit the early days of video games, 50 years after they burst onto the scene. Newman is a professor of English who also teaches in the Media, Cinema, and Digital Studies program in UWM's College of Letters and Science. So let's get started. Michael, welcome to Curious Campus.
It's great to be here.
So first off, I imagine there might be some listeners today who probably haven't even heard of Pong. So to start, could you maybe tell us a little bit more about Pong, how it worked, or even how you, quote, won a game?
Pong is extremely simple. It's a black and white game, and it's a version of table tennis. So it's racket sports. It's instantly understandable by the person who's going to play it. You control a paddle using a knob. The paddle moves up and down on one side of the screen, and the instructions were avoid missing ball for high score. So the ball starts moving, and it's a two-player game, so you bounce the ball off your paddle, and you try to get it to the other side, and maybe your opponent will miss it, and for that you get a point. So it doesn't take a whole lot to figure out. It was extremely simple, but also a lot of fun.
Sure, sure. And back then, it was a two-player game, so you had to have somebody else. Did they had AI come along eventually where you could play the computer, right?
Yes. Initially, it's a two-player game, so the coin-operated Pong, and then eventually the home version of Pong had two knobs, and you'd stand or sit side by side with your opponent.
Okay. So it was not the first video game on the market way back in 1972, but it was the first mass hit. So why did it become so popular when other attempts perhaps did not hit that mark?
There hadn't been very many that had been made available widely for people to play. There had been some coin-operated attempts put in public places where you might find pinball machines or other amusements. So it was among the first that people would have had a chance to play. It was fun and easy to figure out and instantly appealing. You didn't need to learn a bunch of rules. It wasn't too complex. So I think the simplicity is a big part of it. The founder of Atari, which is the company that released Pong, Nolan Bushnell, had this idea that a good game would reward the first quarter and the 100th. And so it would be easy to learn, but challenging, you know, difficult to master. And that's a big part of the appeal of it.
So you'd have people who continued to come back. That was the mark of a success.
Sure. Like any game, the first time you try it, you're not going to knock it out of the park. So the first time you play, you might miss the ball entirely and, you know, be embarrassed, but you want to master it. You want to keep trying.
Exactly. I have this great memory, and mind you, this was a different time, of going to the mall with my parents and being left at the Pong and the Atari 2600 consoles at Sears to play for an hour or maybe even more while they went and they did their shopping. Did you have any experience playing Pong while you were growing up?
I don't really remember Pong. So I'm 50 years old, and that means I'm about as old as the game, and so I wouldn't have played it in 1972. I remember games that came along a bit later, the late 70s or early 80s, and I discovered Pong as an adult, probably.
And what did you play when you got into your video game playing as you were growing up?
The ones that I remember really fondly would have been the arcade cabinets that were in a convenience store near where I grew up in Toronto. So a few blocks from home, I could ride my bike there, go there with friends. And it was just, you know, the kind of store where you would buy milk if you ran out, or candy or magazines. Mm-hmm. They put some cabinets in that store when these were really popular. There were some pinball and some video games. I played Ms. Pac-Man. I played Tron and Tempest. I played pinball. Those would have been the ones that were most available to me because I didn't have it in the home. But arcades were, incorporating video games a lot, and some of them became really popular spots for kids, like birthday party centers, things like that.
Mm-hmm. I believe you've said in a previous interview that Ms. Pac-Man was your favorite game growing up. What was it about Ms. Pac-Man that drew you to it?
They had Ms. Pac-Man at that convenience store, so first of all, it was available. I think I liked it that it was fun and cute and colorful. It's definitely a game that's easy to learn and difficult to master. So, you have to figure out how to navigate a maze and evade the ghosts that are chasing after you. And the more you play, the more your skill develops. I guess I played that one enough that I got to be fairly good at it. And also in that game, if you succeed a bit by clearing all of the bits, the pellets and wafers or whatever's on the screen over two boards of the game, it shows you a little movie. So you get rewarded for being good at the game by being shown this little animated digital movie about the pursuit of Ms. Pac-Man by Pac-Man.
I'm going to circle back to Pong because we're getting a little bit further down the time stream in terms of video games. But in your book, you covered Pong prominently, and I'd like to get into your book and what you wrote about Pong in there, in the book. What can you tell us about Atari Age, and why did you write it?
Well, I was initially interested in looking at video games as part of the history of television, actually. We think of them as pretty distinct, different media now, but when they were new, they were this thing that you could plug into a television set and do something with the TV other than watch the shows that would come over the air from the TV stations and networks. And at the time, this was seen as a kind of upgrade for television. Around the same time VCRs came out, so video decks where you could record television or you could get pre-recorded tapes like movies, which became very familiar. And, that was a hugely successful technology. That became just a normal part of what you would do with a TV. And cable hadn't come along yet either. So I was interested in how TV changed over the years. And, I think we often just think of video games as their own thing, but the word video means television. And they came to have the identity that they have in relation to TV. So that's where I got started. I was also interested in looking at that early period, which I think hadn't been written about that much in any interesting way, to understand what video games were when they were new and how they fit into our concept of media, of culture, of play, of childhood amusement.
Yeah, I mean, this is going back to, personally, my basic first 10 years of existence. And I remember it kind of being a change in mindset when you took, okay, you can play video games in an arcade or a pinball machine at a bowling alley or something versus you can do this in your home. And instead of watching Three's Company or MASH at night, you can hook this up to your TV, and it's a whole other world that opens up. And Pong was really the first way people could do this, right?
That's right. And that was a big part of how it was packaged and marketed, was as a new trick your TV can do, a way to make television into something participatory. Instead of just watching whatever's on, you get to interact with the television. You get to make something move on a TV. I think we really have a hard time imagining what that was like for people in the 70s because we're constantly making things happen on screens. That's just become integrated into our kind of moment-by-moment existence. But just the idea that you could manipulate something on a screen or type words and they would appear on a screen was pretty exciting to people when they had never seen that before.
Yeah, and I mean, the interaction, the whole concept of playing a game on the screen was entirely different. I mean, you know, if you're going to go out and play tennis on a court, you've got to have some level of athleticism. But that wasn't the case with Pong. You could basically be playing tennis on your TV.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of other amusements as well. So there were versions that were also like hockey or soccer or basketball or baseball. In some ways, it was like playing board games because there had been, you know, board game versions of other things like sports as well. But it was definitely a movement in amusement towards more experiences in the home as opposed to outside, you know, in the family room or the rec room.
Mm-hmm. I'm guessing there are some people out there who might be thinking it's a pretty good gig to be able to study and write about video games for a living. So what got you interested in video games? How did you get into it? And how did it become such an important part of your life?
I spent a lot of time playing them as a kid, as many people of my generation and younger generations did. So I never really set out to become an expert or a scholar of this topic. I was, doing work studying media, more generally film and television and popular culture. And they all have some things in common, and they can all be studied using some of the same tools as a matter of cultural history or media history, or thinking about these media texts, which is a kind of academic way of talking about games or shows or movies or stories, and analyzing them, interpreting them, and thinking about how they fit into society and what meanings they have.
What are some things you learned while researching this that might surprise some folks?
A lot of things. Well, I knew that people had kind of freaked out about video games because I remember that from when I was around 10 years old. I knew that there were panics and a lot of fears about how young people were being affected by the games. And people worried about kids not doing well in school, not getting enough sleep, maybe harming their brains or their eyes. So I knew that that was a fear, and that's pretty typical when new media technologies come along and seem so seductive, especially to young people. I don't know that I realized how much there was a flip side to that of feeling hopeful and optimistic about how young people were going to use these new technologies to become familiar with computers or with just the high-tech tools of the information age. So there was some negative reaction, but there was also some positive reaction that this was the new world that was opening up to young people and that it was exciting.
You're listening to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Howie Magner, and today we're talking about the 50th anniversary of the classic video game Pong and the impact that early video games had on pop culture. Our guest is Michael Newman, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee. He wrote a book that was published in 2017 called Atari Age, The Emergence of Video Games in America. So I remember the battles over, you know, movies had been labeled for age groups, you know, for quite some time. But when video games first came out, there wasn't anything of the sort. And there was quite the battle of, okay, you need to mark what games are age appropriate, right?
Yeah. So a rating system developed. I mean, there also was no ratings or warnings for music or television at the mm-hmm. time. Those developed a little bit later than the period that we're talking about for video games, which had a kind of sustained presence as a source of trouble that people worried about or freaked out about. There were probably some games that people thought were kind of inappropriate for children,
mm-hmm.
But they were being marketed to children. So the video games industry at the time didn't have a whole lot of interest in pushing that too far. A lot of the popular games were like Space Invaders or Pac-Man, they're fairly abstract. They're about shooting aliens or, you know, eating ghosts. And the contents of those games might not have been the source of the fear.
Sure. I think it really picked up when the first-person shooters and things like that came along. And that's way down the line.
Sure. Or fighting games. And actually, for me, who's not too interested in that kind of thing, I might have turned away more when I saw the Mortal Kombat type of games mm-hmm. where the blood and gore seemed like part of the appeal. That would have been the later 80s.
Right. But this strikes me as the types of concerns that happen whenever any type of new media comes on the scene, right? There's you know, it's a new medium, and there's always the concern of how is this going to affect the people who are using it, because we don't have experience with it previously.
Absolutely. It's been a big part of modern life, movies and television and rock music and smartphones and so many new things when they come along, because the parent generation is unfamiliar with them and didn't grow up with them. And children or young people find them to be like magnets for their attention.
Right.
I think that that's going to cause trouble.
I mean, does anything come to mind? Like, you know, we had the smartphone revolution of the past 15, 20 years. Are there any comparisons to be made between when Pong and video games took off versus when smartphones took off?
I think that the continuities go back before video games, and they're going to keep on going into the future, though, you know, historians don't like to predict. But it seems like a pretty cyclical kind of phenomenon. And, you know, Pong itself was not seen as particularly threatening. When it was new, it was in some ways seen as a hopeful sign that maybe what had been a passive experience of watching television could become a more social experience of using television to do things with others, even though Pong isn't that interesting. You know, it's fun, and it gives people a new way to be social. Within a few years, into the early 80s, the panic would be more present because video games had become a big industry, and there were so many of them, and so many people were spending a lot of time with them, especially young people. So all the things that we hear about screen time, really kind of resonates with past experiences that the screens are different screens, but the worries are similar worries.
Mm-hmm. I do remember, being told go outside and play, you know, the time was limited, and it makes sense. It was a new thing. So you wanted to spend time doing it. But even back then, my parents and the parents of my friends would say, all right, you get to do an hour, but then you got to go outside and toss the football around or play baseball or something like that.
Sure. And think about how much parents have been managing children's television watching, and that goes back to the 50s. So there's definitely a lot of kind of control and, you know, a kind of a watchful eye over the children's use of TV. That might be a particularly middle-class thing, but it's certainly been going on for a long time. And the idea of screen time really develops out of concerns about television and how much TV time people are letting their kids have.
So you turned 50 this year, you mentioned, just like Pong. You mentioned in your book and in doing the research, you also relived a part of your childhood. So what was that like for you, doing your research and kind of going back and marrying the work today to your experiences as a kid?
It's really interesting. So I tried not to be too nostalgic because that wasn't what motivated me to do this. I'm interested in trying to see video games as people saw them then, not to look back fondly on my experience, but to try to open up by looking at all of the things that people said about games in magazines and newspapers and looking at advertisements and basically anything I could find that would represent what ideas were out there at the time, try to kind of step out of myself and into the mindset of people then. So in some ways, I was trying to avoid that nostalgia, but it's not really possible because we can't step out of ourselves. So some of it was just remembering things that I might not have, like TV commercials that I hadn't seen in a long time. Some of it was eye-opening because, you know, I learned things about some of these games that I never would have found out at the time, like Pac-Man had been developed as a game that would appeal to both men and women or to both genders. And I can totally see that when it's revealed to me that it's a cute game, it's cartoony, it's not aggressive and violent in the same way that the games like Defender and Asteroids and Missile Command are. They have this kind of Cold War confrontation going on. So, you know, Pac-Man is appealing to me, and Ms. Pac-Man was, and maybe part of it was that it appealed to me as something cute, you know, as a kid, as opposed to something violent and aggressive.
And that was, I mean, as you mentioned, the video games kind of skewed in one direction. And so that type of stuff did appeal more to young boys and teen boys versus women. So was Pac-Man the beginning of kind of a push to include everybody?
It was. It was from Japan rather than the U.S. You know, Atari is an American company, even though they have a Japanese name. And the early years of video games were kind of in tension. On the one hand, there was this effort to make them into family fun, into the same kind of thing as board games. And a lot of the advertising and marketing imagery would have been of families in a circle, like the family circle of lots of advertising for 7-Up or TV sets, where you would see people coming together. And that would be the fantasy that would be sold, that the video games are going to bring everybody together and play. But the genres of games that were being made and that were popular and the kinds of play that developed were often what I think of as a kind of boy culture. They came from traditions of aggressive masculine play outdoors, bringing it indoors. So genres like war, sci-fi, shooting games, sports games, those kind of things, you know, they were played by everybody. Like, girls have always played games and enjoyed games and been part of the culture of video games. But there's a skew there more towards the masculine, and that comes from who made the games, though some games were made by women. Mostly they were made by men, and who they were marketed to. And, you know, market research at the time revealed that the most avid players statistically were younger and male.
Is it evening out more these days, or does that still hold the skew?
I think there's a ton of conflict and tension around this topic. So games have expanded so much since then. The industry is enormous. And my research on this is mainly in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, I can speak to that better. But video games are such a huge industry, and there's so many different kinds that it's hard to simplify them and to speak in general terms. But, you know, there have been many moments and episodes of friction over gender and gaming.
So then let's go back in time, back to Pong again. And, you know, we've mentioned previously that it was the first mass hit. So how did the game industry grow from that? I mean, how does it go from just being Pong to the seeds of everything that we see now?
Sure. Pong was a particular kind of game. It was called a ball and paddle game, and it was not really a computer technology. It used TV-type electronics, and it was popular. The consoles sold well for the home. They were popular in public places, too. But other kinds of coin-operated amusements were also popular, like pinball or like electromechanical rifle shooter games, or, you know, the kind of games you would find in a resort town arcade or a bowling alley arcade. By the later 1970s, more computer technology was being used. The graphics were becoming colorful, more sophisticated. The consoles, like the Atari, initially it was called the Atari VCS, and then the 2600, accepted cartridges so that you could play many different games. And it was with hit games like Space Invaders and Pac-Man that it became a really big industry. And it became part of pop culture that would rival movies and TV and other, you know, fixtures of entertainment and show business.
So
it took a few years, but that was part of it.
So the technology fed off the creative, and the creative fed off the technology, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So this year, in addition to the 50th anniversary of Pong, it's also the 50th anniversary of the first home console, the Magnavox Odyssey. Now, I don't personally remember the Odyssey. My big console memories are the Atari 2600 and ColecoVision, but how was the Odyssey connected to Pong?
Pong was an Atari product, but it was not really invented by them. In some ways, it was a copycat of a prototype that had been made by an inventor named Ralph Baer in the late 1960s. Nolan Bushnell of Atari had seen this prototype. A lot of people had seen it. And it became the basis for Magnavox Odyssey. It was licensed to Magnavox, which was an electronics company that made TV sets and other electronics. It came out around the same time as Pong. They both came out in the same year. And Odyssey Tennis is pretty similar to Pong. They're not identical, but that would have been the initial home version of Pong. And then Atari marketed Pong for the home, and it was available through Sears. Maybe that's what you saw at the mall, or other companies also made pretty similar consoles that were ball and paddle games where you bounce a ball. So Odyssey and Pong emerged around the same time. One was a coin-operated game initially, Pong, and one was a home console. And Odyssey could do some other things too. It played a bunch of different games, but it was a little bit more like a hybrid of a board game and a video game because it required some cardboard and paper and plastic tokens to play some of the games in it. Like there's a football game where you have a green rectangle. That's the field that you put on the table. It has an instruction booklet. You don't usually think of video games needing instructions like board games do when you first play them. So it's a bit of a curious thing. But it really was the first home video game.
That might be a reason why it didn't succeed and others did, because people didn't want to have to do stuff. They wanted to be absorbed by the TV.
I think that's right. Also, it seems like it has one foot in the past and one foot in the present.
Sure, sure. We're coming up on the end of our time here, but I want to go back to the whole idea of the simplicity of Pong being a big reason for its success. And that really comes to the fore, especially when you compare it to the more complex games today, like Minecraft or the Madden football franchise. And look, my kids, and hi, Dorothy, hi, Ray, they have tried to get me into Minecraft, and I cannot get past the learning curve for it. So I want to end by kind of asking you about the appeal of simplicity in games and whether you see evidence of that simplicity still appealing to a mass population, or are we too far down the road where a game has to really be complex to be successful?
I think that's a great question. I think that video games can be many different things, and we might think like the epitome of a game would be the more sophisticated or complex ones that the gamer seems to own as their object of interest. But the kind of games that people play on mobile devices that you can play for a couple minutes when you're in line at the post office or, you know, just killing time, those are really appealing. And often those are also pretty simple. I think some of the hit games in the history of video games like Tetris and Angry Birds have been pretty easy to learn. Maybe not as easy as Pong, but still fairly straightforward. And I think we could even think of something like Wordle, the word game that has been such a phenomenon in the last few months. We might not think of that as a video game, but, you know, it's a game that uses a screen. It's electronic. You give input to it and something happens. It's pretty simple. You just guess 5-letter words. So I think sometimes these really popular games are exactly the simple, appealing, fun ones that you don't need to spend a whole lot of time figuring out.
Well, Michael, it's been a lot of fun traveling down memory lane with you about video games. And thanks very much for joining us, and continued good luck with your work.
Thanks for having me.
That's today's show. Thanks for listening. Our guest today was Michael Newman, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee. Curious Campus is produced by Gennaro Armas. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Howie Magner. If you enjoyed our show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app. We'll